And welcome, welcome, welcome to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Jim Caruso, I am in Singapore.
You are? No, no one
I
told
am.
Me. How's Singapore?
It's hot and muggy. Yesterday I was wearing glasses, and as soon as I walked out of my room, they fogged up. So I've got my contacts back in, and things are better.
That's good. Well, it's good that you're in Singapore, because that's where our guest is as well.
All right, Jim, it sounds like you're up. Who's our guest?
Oh, yes. It's Nidhin Yao. She is the managing director of Bauer Group Asia. She was previously with the Ministry of Commerce, wasn't it, Nidhin?
Trade and Industry.
Trade and Investment. I knew it was one of those. Posted to the embassy in Washington, where she helped negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which became the CPTPP when the U.S. pulled out. But Nidhin knows a lot about Singapore, knows a lot about trade, knows a lot about international relations. And since we're talking about why should we care about things in the Indo-Pacific, I thought it'd be very interesting to say, why should Americans care about a country with a population of 6 million people, about 3.5 times the size of Washington, D.C.? Why should Americans think about Singapore, Nidhin?
Why should Americans care about this little red dot out in the Pacific?
Yeah.
happy to talk about it, and thanks for inviting me to be on. I think there's a lot of reasons why folks should care about Singapore, and I think a big part of that is also the reason why Ray is in town this week, right? We are hosting two big events, or I should stop saying we because I'm no longer part of the Singapore government, but which I'm sure is a habit that you guys also find difficult to get rid of sometimes. But the Singapore government is basically hosting two big events taking place this week, one of which is Asia Tech Summit, which is, really the Ministry of Communications and Information's big flagship event of the year. And the other is the Shangri-La Dialogue. So I think, that really goes to show how important Singapore is in terms of, on the one hand, it's the work that is done with regards to innovation and technology, but on the other hand, also recognizing its significance in terms of it being a strategic location, but also how it has really supported the international ecosystem writ large by fostering, multilateral cooperation through events like the Shangri-La Dialogue as well.
Nidhin, I'm actually sort of amazed by the Shangri-La Dialogue. Of course, I mean, I've sort of watched it from afar for many, many years. I've never really had a reason to go before, but it's really become the big defense and security event of the year for the Indo-Pacific. Any idea how that happened? I mean, how did it all sort of happen here in Singapore?
That's a really good question, and not one that I can really probably answer adequately, but I can give it a try. I think it's really been a platform where there's neutral enough that countries can come together to talk about difficult issues. And I think, we've seen that sort of happen a little bit already through some of the work that Singapore has done in terms of facilitating dialogue, especially when, Singapore hosted the Trumpkin Summit a couple years back. And I think that, it's through platforms like these that allow it to really push the Shangri-La Dialogue forward in terms of being a platform where you can also, come together and discuss, strategic issues of importance, bring together a good group of leaders that can actually have conversations like this. And I think, the organizers, the International Institute of Strategic Studies have really done a really good job in terms of making sure that there's a really good agenda and that, there's really discussions and panelists that are that people want to see and talk about. And of course, companies are willing to also pay and sponsor for, to be a part of these events. And I think that that's really helped it help move that needle along.
So you mentioned Singapore being sort of a neutral ground where folks can get together and discuss things, but being neutral these days is becoming more and more difficult. with the increased tension between U.S. and China. How does Singapore navigate that path?
I think Singapore has always taken a fairly balanced approach. I think it's definitely not easy, but you know, our new prime minister has said it really eloquently in the past couple of weeks, where he's, you know, talked about how Singapore isn't pro-US, it isn't pro-China, it really is just pro-Singapore. And what that means is making decisions that are really with, at the back of the mind, what Singapore's, you know, main interests are. So in that sense, you know, we definitely want to see the U.S. engage in this region. We think that that's very important. And so, you know, we do that through events like the Shangri-La Dialogue. We do that by offering to host, you know, the Indo-Pacific Economic Frameworks Ministerial that's taking place next week, where I think Gina Raimondo is coming to Singapore as well. You know, but we also pair that up with, you know, visits or meetings with China as well. So for instance, I think, you know, a very good example that I always talk about is, you know, our new prime minister, when he was still deputy prime minister, went to the US in October to launch the dialogue on critical and emerging technologies. And that took place in October 2023. Shortly after that, in December, he went to China to, you know, chair the JCBC for the first time. And so, you know, by balancing that, you know, constant visits to the US with meetings with China, you know, I think that's how Singapore really looks at it in terms of trying to kind of navigate the dynamics between the two. You know, I think the economic relationships are there. I think the strategic relationships are there as well. And so it's really looking at, you know, what would really be in Singapore's best interests.
Nidia, when you look at a map, obviously what stands out about Singapore is its size. It's a city-state and surrounded by much larger countries, which, you know, just looking at it would seem like a precarious situation to be in. And of course, Singapore was conquered by Imperial Japan in 1942. When Singapore looks out at the world, what does it see as its main security threats?
I think definitely the small size is something that Singapore has always struggled to deal with. And I think, you know, it's really ingrained in Singaporeans, you know, this whole, the possibility that we could be invaded one day, just how vulnerable Singapore is really as a country. And I think that in order to really circumvent those threats, and they could come from anywhere, right? It could be external threats in terms of, like, you know, we were bombed by Indonesia back in the 60s, I think, if my memory serves me correct, during the Konfrontasi period, or it could be in the 50s. And that could easily happen to us again, but also it could be terrorism, right? We've seen domestic terrorism happen in our neighboring countries, and it could also happen to us. And so, like, I think how we kind of look to circumvent that is through very strategic arrangements that we do with other countries. So for instance, we have like the five power defense arrangements with, I think, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK together with Malaysia. But we also, you know, complement that with, I think, a very sophisticated network internally as well. And look towards working with, I think, within the Ministry of Home Affairs, they also, you know, kind of have a very great network to kind of spot those domestic threats as well.
Well, also Singapore has the poison shrimp approach to its defense that if you bite it, you're going to get sick, because you have a very efficient military, high-tech equipment, including the Joint Strike Fighter. So the government has recognized there are threats and is working hard to overcome those. To me, the bigger threat is Singapore has achieved this remarkable economic success by being an open trading hub, welcoming finance, welcoming traders. And though it has a tiny domestic market, it serves as a hub for trade throughout the region. Now, with increasing protectionism, certainly from the United States, from other countries as well, is this model under threat?
I think it's definitely something that the Singapore government is worried about in terms of increased protectionism. And I think, you know, the tariffs that were recently put in place also certainly doesn't help just because of how Singapore is integrated into the global supply chains. I think that what's really worrying Singapore right now is also the implementation of BEPS when Singapore is going to have to implement a minimum effective tax rate of 15%. And then how are they continuing to you know, really be an attractive investment location for companies going forward? And I think that that's really something that they are, the Economic Development Board is really very concerned by, and you know, trying to ensure that Singapore continues to remain an investment destination that is attractive. And so it's very interesting that to actually see, you know, in the past couple months, we've seen a lot of big companies announce big investments in Singapore. So you see companies like AWS, companies like Microsoft, Apple have all, you know, made very big investments in Singapore just announced in the past couple months, which I think shows the EDB being hard at work and trying to get these investments in.
Nidhi, for people who don't or aren't familiar with sort of how Singapore came to be, why is there Singapore? Why is there this independent city-state sort of sandwiched in between these larger states? How did that happen historically?
You mean when Malaysia kicked us out in 1965?
That's the brief version.
Yeah, that's essentially what happened. And that's how we ended up with, you know, probably the only other country outside of China with a Chinese majority. But it's also a big reason why we just, I think, it was just untenable for us to stay in Malaysia just because of, you know, the different points of view, just being, you know, a Chinese majority state. And with Malaysia at that time wanting to favor really the Bumiputras. And for us, it was Singapore is very big on meritocracy. And Singapore is, you know, I think just by virtue of our founding prime minister, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, we're always very pragmatic and very almost Machiavellian in a way where he talks about how, you know, it's better to be feared than loved, but of course best if you're both feared and loved. But I think it's very much that very practical mindset of like what is the most practical thing to do. And I think that's really helped Singapore become Singapore in the years since we got kicked out and had to fend for ourselves. It's really, you know, like when we talk about earlier about how, you know, Singapore is fairly vulnerable. You know, it's really this messaging that we've gotten over the years, especially when you're a student in Singapore, about how it's important to be, you know, resilient because we're so vulnerable. We are at constant risk of being attacked in various ways, or there are always these threats that can come in. And so I think the Singapore government has really done a good job in terms of, you know, making sure that Singaporeans all grow up with this, you know, mindset of having to be resilient.
Well, you know, it's a remarkable feat that while there's an ethnic Chinese majority, there are large ethnic Malay and Indian minorities. And yet there's social cohesion by and large, at least so far, which may be attributed to the leadership of the three previous prime ministers. So what can we expect from the brand new prime minister?
I think maybe I would just slightly disagree with you there, because I think there have been legislation in place to just keep the peace between the races. So in that sense, you know, anything that touches on racial or religious sensitivities are immediately, you know, illegal. And so I think if you have to rely on legislation to kind of keep the peace, then it's a little bit superficial in that sense. And then there's also, you know, in terms of like the public housing quotas for the different race groups to meet, right? Like you need to have a certain quota of Indian families or a certain quota of Malay families within your HDB buildings. So that's a little bit of an artificial construct there. And I think with the current Israel-Hamas conflict, you know, I think the leaders are very worried about how they are worried, and they're also very mindful about how they're handling the situation, just because they don't want to alienate or isolate the Malay Muslim community. And that's really top of mind for them, especially this close to an election. But I think that in terms of the new prime minister, I think you can expect more of the same, which is really Singapore's selling point, right? It's constant stability, which makes it so attractive to businesses. But I think top of mind for him is really ensuring inclusion within this inclusivity within the Singapore society. I think he's going to be focusing on strengthening the social compact, and you'll see that with his landmark Forward Singapore initiative, where he basically looks to consult Singaporeans on what they think is necessary or needed. A lot of it talks about, you know, moving away from your traditional definitions of success and finding, you know, new opportunities for success. So instead of for companies, for instance, instead of hiring someone who has a traditional degree, you know, maybe companies should look towards hiring based on skills instead. You know, instead of having, you know, your traditional definitions of success being your 5 C's, you know, your cash, credit card, country club, car, whatever. How do you look at different definitions of success and what success looks like? So it's very much along those veins. And I think, you know, but I think for most part, it's really, the message is really continuity. You see that in his cabinet. You see that in his choice of deputy prime ministers. And really with the reshuffle that came in when he was sworn in, it really wasn't much of a reshuffle because everyone pretty much maintained their same portfolios. You know, it's really to make sure that everyone is at ease with this transition. And, you know, this is the first time that we don't have a Lee in the waiting. I think in terms of like the big portfolios that we're looking at, you know, foreign affairs, security, defense, it's still very much led by your 3G leaders, your third generation leaders. So in that sense, it's very much wanting to assure everyone that everything will still be, you know, the same. You don't have to worry. There's no like major bumps that you need to worry about in the future. And I think that, you know, post-elections will be when that bigger reshuffle will take place. But even then, I think the big national security related portfolios will still be in very safe pair of hands. Yeah.
So what you just talked about, Nidia, is I think probably sounds strange to a lot of Western ears, because of course, you know, in the U.S., we go through political transitions all the time, and some of them are quite major. You know, you go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump to Joe Biden, you know, and this. So we're constantly sort of swinging back and forth in that way. And yet in Singapore, you've essentially had one party has been in charge for pretty much your whole, you know, independent history. How does Singapore look at this balance between political stability, social stability on one hand, and, you know, civil liberties on the other? You know, because generally speaking, as Americans, for example, we tend to think, well, we need to have those checks and balances so that we don't have, you know, kind of a tyranny or authoritarian rule. How does Singapore look at that?
I think Singapore has tried to address that by increasing the number of seats in parliament. So we've seen an increase in the number of just the number of seats for each constituency increase. We also have seen, I think it was Prime Minister Lee that looked at this idea of a nominated member of parliament just to include a more diverse set of voices in parliament. And I think that that's Singapore's way of addressing those certain like liberties. And I think now with, especially with the rise of social media, you really do see more people clamoring to be heard. And that's also, I think, impacted the last couple elections that we've had. In 2020, I think, you know, there were people that were upset that elections were being held in the middle of the pandemic. And Jim was here for that too. And I think, you know, it was clear that social media definitely played a very big role in terms of even to the point where, you know, because of comments on social media, the ruling party actually withdrew a candidate that was going to be fielded in a constituency and then replaced him with someone else, which I don't think has hardly ever happened before, not for Singapore at least. And so I think, you know, and then with the 2020 elections too, we saw the ruling party actually perform quite poorly. In fact, the second poorest result that it has ever gotten. And the ruling party lost two group representative constituencies, which is like, they lost two constituencies. And it's, but it was a very big deal considering that they only, considering that this was only the second one that they lost. But as a result of that, we now have a leader of the opposition, which we never had before. An official position for the leader of the opposition. And so I think, you know, we're taking very baby steps towards getting there. And I think, you know, the next kind of milestone to look out for is really at what point Singapore gets to that point where the government, the ruling party only controls 2/3 of the seats in parliament, because that's when you get the big changes, like, you know, in terms of being able to really have an impact in terms of things like the constitution and being able to really play a bigger role in terms of making people's voices heard. At this point, I think we only have about 10 or so seats that are with the opposition, which is not much, but it's a start.
So a lot of it is all related to the search for stability and security as a small, vulnerable state. And I think we see this also in Singapore, somewhat surprisingly, coming out very strongly against Russia's invasion of Ukraine because of the rules being violated. But now as Singapore tries to manage the rise of China and China's effort to change some of the international rules, as we see in the South China Sea, again, how does Singapore influence that rise so that Singapore and other states in the region, in ASEAN, maintain its full sovereignty while not messing up the economic relationship with China or falling under too much Chinese sway? This is the big conundrum I see.
Someone in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs recently told me that, you know, Singapore's foreign policy can be summed up really with three words. And it, I feel like I've also mentioned those at some point in this conversation, where it is consistent, it is principled, and it's pragmatic. And so I think, you know, that's really how they would look at it. And really, these are like the principles that they'll bear in mind as they look towards dealing with China. It's also worth bearing in mind that Singapore is the largest investor in China, And so there's that economic angle to it as well, which is important. And then at the same time too, Singapore is one of the founding members of ASEAN. And so there is, I think, significance there in terms of playing a leading role in determining what ASEAN does when it comes to China as well. But I think definitely it will be looking to push on the economic levers. You know, China wants to be a part of CPTPP. China wants to be a part of the digital economy agreements that Singapore has in place. They've already signed up and raised their hands to be a part of the digital economy partnership agreement that Singapore has with Chile and New Zealand. And that agreement just welcomed Korea. And so China definitely wants to be part of that as well. And I think just a couple of weeks ago, China was looking at reviewing its ASEAN agreement, its ASEAN FTA, and wanting to include digital economy provisions there too. And so I think that, you know, if you kind of pair or push a bit more on those economic levers, I think that's how Singapore is going to be looking at it, at its relationship with China, but also, you know, maintaining that same approach of just being focusing more on like your rules-based agreements, the rule-based order, because that's really how Singapore has managed to punch above its weight all these years.
In recent years, we've seen a tightening of a lot of China's, we've seen a rising authoritarianism in China. And of course, this has had an impact in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's kind of been typical of some Southeast Asian countries have actually seen some benefit for them in this because countries are displacing from China into other places. Has Singapore seen any benefit from this change?
Oh, absolutely. And I think with that benefit has just come with an influx of expats moving from Hong Kong to Singapore, which has also then subsequently resulted in increasing rents. With the influx of expats, we've also had to deal with increasing rents as well as rising cost of living. But I think that that's par for the course. But and at the same time, too, you know, as we see companies thinking about moving their headquarters from Hong Kong to Singapore, we've definitely seen some of that. But also as companies moving to other parts of Southeast Asia have definitely benefited Singapore. I think Singapore is looking now more at a hub plus strategy where, you know, they invest in Singapore and have Singapore be its regional headquarters, but then they're totally open to having companies move, you know, other parts of their supply chain elsewhere in the region. So they can manufacture in Vietnam, they can do the back-end roles in Malaysia or in Philippines. And we've actually also seen Singapore sign agreements with Johor and with Indonesia to that effect, right? Singapore being such a small country with serious land constraints, we don't have that capacity to just really host that many data centers as we like. And so, you know, one of the things that the Singapore government has done is to work out an agreement with the folks in Batam in Indonesia and set up, I think, in Nongsa, a space where companies can set up their data centers in Indonesia and, you know, but still be headquartered in Singapore. And I think that that's definitely how I think Singapore is looking to benefit from all of this movement to Southeast Asia while still taking into consideration the limitations that it has.
So we talked about how China is being dealt with by Singapore, but maybe a bigger question is with the increasing protectionist and perhaps isolationist tendencies in the US, how does Singapore deal with that?
I think, you know, regardless of who ultimately wins the elections in the US this year, they are both known figures to Singapore. And either way, Singapore will find ways to keep the US engaged in this region, whether or not it's through the defense angle or whether it is through the economic side of the house. I think outside of the Indo-Pacific economic framework, I think that there are a number of bilateral platforms that are already in place. And I don't know if you guys have heard this as much as I have this year being in the job that I do, but did you know that this year is the 20th anniversary of the US-Singapore Free Trade Agreement? So, Singapore takes a lot of pride in terms of having it be the gold standard agreement, as well as being, one of the rare few free trade agreements that the US has with this region. And I think that that is definitely something that Singapore has benefited from. But that's also something that the US has benefited from, because if you're looking at, the Trump administration's point of view in terms of who made a great trading partner and who didn't, I think, he looked at it in terms of trade surpluses and deficits, and the US has a trade surplus with Singapore. So that definitely helps, and I think is one way forward in terms of, continuing to keep the US interested and engaged in Singapore. I think that there are also, in terms of being worried about what the US is going to do with its protectionist policies, I think that the IPEF supply chain agreement does help in a way to ensure that, that regardless of what decisions any of these IPEF economies might take in the future, that there will be international agreements in place to ensure that, no one actually takes any policies that might impact Singapore in that kind of way. But I think there's definitely also a lot of concern with other countries looking at what the US is doing, whether or not they'll then follow suit. And then it just leads into this, whole uncomfortable cycle of other countries in the region also taking protectionist policies. And then how do you then deal with that? But I think that that's also a big reason why Singapore places such importance in terms of international platforms, multilateral platforms, and the rules-based order, because without all of these rules, anyone can do anything that they want, and then that means that Singapore just ends up being the only one left trying to play by the rules and not really getting anything much from it. But I think that's also so important, why it's so important for these agreements to have teeth. And I think a lot of people were very worried about what would happen to IPEF should the elections turn out a certain way and then the US pulls out again. It's like once bitten, twice shy, right? We've seen that happen with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so I think, what they're trying to do now is really to make sure that that doesn't happen again. And the good thing is that, I think the supply chain agreement has already been signed, and so it's just, and possibly already in force as well. So I think those are ways in which Singapore, deals with those policies that the US comes up with.
All right, Nidia. Well, Jim asked the first question, so I'm going to take the last one. It occurs to me that it's been 30 years since the U.S. headlines had in it the name Michael Fay, who was caned in Singapore when he got in trouble in Singapore. And I guess this sort of shocked the sensibilities of a lot of Americans. So I guess a double-barreled question here. First, is caning still a thing in Singapore? And if so, how do I avoid getting caned this week?
I believe caning is still something in Singapore, but I think you should be fine.
Well, it sounds like Ray's looking forward to it.
What are you planning to get up to that would put you at risk of being caned?
Hey, nobody explains the rules behind caning when you come into the country.
I think as long as you don't break any laws, you should be fine.
Well, good.
Trying to avoid
that. So don't jaywalk. Don't chew gum. Or don't offer chewing gum to anyone, maybe.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I'm feeling better. All right, Nydia, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you joining us today. And we'll be seeing you in a different capacity tomorrow. So I look forward to meeting you tomorrow.
Likewise. Thank you.
So Singapore is a remarkable success story, a country which was basically founded in chaos with different ethnic groups vying for power, with two big countries as neighbors who wanted to absorb it, no natural resources, no hinterland, somehow becomes one of the richest countries in the world.
Yeah, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways, Singapore is what a lot of other countries wish they could be, right? I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, and there are countries that sort of wonder whether, you know, there's a way to sort of replicate what Singapore is. I mean, certainly felt like that when I was in Vietnam. And, you know, it's the idea that you could have at least for a long period of time, a pretty restrictive political system, and still not sort of descend into a brutal kind of authoritarian regime. Now, we don't know if that can, you know, I've always sort of wondered how long that can last. Now, maybe, you know, we've seen, as we've talked with Nydia, you know, that Singapore is just sort of moving gradually toward a more pluralistic political system, you know, where you get, you know, different viable parties. And maybe, you know, they'll be able to sort of make that transition in a smooth way. It is really sort of a remarkable thing, and not really sure how replicable it is in other places.
Well, I think part of the key is the fact it's so small. But it's also the ethos of Lee Kuan Yew, the founder, was we need stability because we're so small, but we also have to deliver. So if you are found guilty of corruption, you get to enjoy your money while hanging at the end of a rope. They pay their ministers and civil servants really well, so there's no need to be corrupt, but you're also expected, again, to work hard and deliver. They have a lot of members of parliament for the size of the population, and those members go out and walk their constituencies and listen to the people. So there's that interaction, which I think Singaporeans appreciate, that they have a voice to government. And while they may not have a lot of opposition parties, they have a way to let their voices be heard and government respond by and large. But maybe that only works in a small community.
I was a little unfair with Nydia, I think, you know, kind of leveling on her the question about security, since that's not necessarily her forte, and maybe one that we ought to take up later. But I mean, it really is, you know, when you are such a small country, you have no what we call strategic depth. If you're hit, there's nowhere to retreat to. You've just got to stand and fight or surrender. You know, it is really, you know, and of course, Singapore has no formal alliances. So they have managed to, you know, really sort of carve out a niche for themselves that so far has worked out remarkably well, considering the fact that, you know, where they sit is extremely strategic. And again, in 1942, somebody did decide that they would like to have that piece of territory, thank you very much, and took it. And so, you know, I know that I've met quite a few Singaporean military officers, and that's a very serious bunch.
They are. They are fully aware of the risk that Singapore is always under. On the other hand, what Singapore has done is created relationships with the governments in Malaysia and Indonesia and the business communities there. Frankly, a lot of the wealthy people keep their money in Singapore to keep it safe and offshore. So they've created a network of mutual interest, which keeps them more secure. To me, the hardest thing for them to navigate is Philippines, as a member of ASEAN, trying to maintain the rules under international law of the sea, and China violating those rules. How does Singapore manage that? And the way they seem to do it is sort of hiding, I'll use the word hiding, behind ASEAN.
Well, Jim, we are come upon that time where you owe me a story. So it is time for There I Was. And you you indicated to me before that you might have a Singapore story for me.
I do, Ray. So I left government service and went to Singapore, where I actually had Nidhi's job as managing director of a consulting firm in Singapore. And I got there a week before COVID hit and everything was locked down. And a few months later, I had to fly back to the U.S. for a family emergency. And they had to fly back in. And it took me weeks to get permission to fly back in. When I finally did, on a flight that was basically maybe one-fifth full, we get to the airport. We are waiting in two lines to hand all our health papers to unsmiling bureaucrats, who then give us a yellow sticker to put on our chests. Yes, a bad color for historical reasons. And told to wait in this line where we will be put on a bus. Not told where we're going, just be put on the bus and we'll know where we're going when we get there. And we've heard that there are various hotels they put you up for 2 weeks quarantine, where you're not allowed to leave the room. And it could be a hotel with no windows that open, that's very dark, or it could be on the holiday island of Sentosa with view of the beach. So fingers crossed, we're going. Yay, it's Sentosa. And we managed to get two adjoining rooms, so I had a room to work in, and the view of the beach. Every day, they'd feed us three meals a day. They'd knock on the door. We weren't allowed to open the door for a few seconds while the knocker left, and we'd pick up our plastic container of somewhat unidentifiable slop, and we looked forward to it tremendously. And the other good part of this was our room had a balcony, looked out at the beach, where the folks were allowed to go out and frolic and look back at us in the zoo of the hotel. And there was barbed wire between us and the beach, so we couldn't go out, even though we couldn't go out of our rooms at all. It was surreal being locked up for 2 weeks.
I think
the state plans handle it very well.
Well, that does not surprise me. That sounds very much like what I have come to expect of Singapore is extreme efficiency with that kind of thing. But the last question that I'll have to ask is, were you ever threatened with caning?
You know, I'm no Ray Powell, so no.
All right, Jim. It's been a fun session as always, and thank you for joining us. Thank you, Ian, our producer, for making us look good. And we ask, if you are listening to this and you are enjoying what you hear, please give us a like, please give us a subscribe, please share us with your friends, give us 5 glorious stars and a glowing review. And for Jim and Ian, this is Ray. Thanks once again for joining us on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?